I'm Nicola.
And I'm Jay Percy.
And welcome to the Afro-Animist podcast. We are two Abir women and animist conjurers exploring witchcraft, healing and psychedelics.
The Afro-Animist podcast explores the secular through the spiritual, discussing life experiences through a sacred lens.
Here you'll get to hear talk about philosophy, metaphysics, occultism, shamanism, culture, healing, nature, animism,
the arts, conspiracies, psychedelics, and witchcraft. Nothing is off the table in these discussions, which aim to get to the heart of what it means to be spiritual and Afro-diasporic in an increasingly sterile, authoritarian, and Eurocentric world.
As Afro-Caribbean millennial Londoners, we keep it real whilst exploring the biggest mysteries of our multiverse. Join us in holding this space to cry, laugh, debate, build community and tear down oppressive structures.
Hi there, you beautiful, beautiful being of the multiverse, and welcome to this week's episode of the Afro-Animist podcast. My name is Jay Percy the Artist.
And I'm Nicola. So we have, for me, I know I say this every week, but for me, this is like a really interesting and also super important topic today. So we have, we're going to be talking about cults, abuse, and the dark side of spiritual community, or really any community. What is it like to walk in this world of healing and be faced with cult mentality, mental, physical, and sexual abuse? So many of us are searching for healing, growth, community, and understanding. It can be really easy to fall into cycles of abusive behavior, especially in the spiritual community where there is a belief system that is set in place and unquestionable.
I would like to put a trigger warning on this week's episode. It is quite a heavy episode around the topics that Nicola just stated. So if you're not in the right place in your mind, in your life right now, then please do click off. Your health is important to us. So there are other lighter episodes that might be more suitable for today. So today we're introducing Elizabeth Donoghue. Elizabeth Donoghue is a cult survivor and researcher working in mental health and academia. Her birth mother survived child sexual abuse at the hands of the Irish paedophile priest Father Brendan Smith and was later institutionalised in a St Vincent de Paul mother and baby home run by the Daughters of Charity during her pregnancy. Elizabeth was forcibly separated from her mother at birth and handed to nuns. She was later adopted through the Catholic Crusade of Rescue as a replacement child to a family who had just lost their daughter and who already had two biological sons. Her adoptive family was connected to missionary priests and a Catholic order of priests and nuns later exposed for systemic child abuse. She was excommunicated by the family and order after finding her biological parents in adulthood and then drawn her lived experience to get an education and deprogram herself from coercive control and totalizing ideologies. Her PhD was on adoption reunion and she has published widely on adoption, cults and trauma. Her Instagram is herstorylondon.
So good to have you here today, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to actually speak to you about this today. Before we get into it, do you want to give us just a little bit of a download on your work and the kind of thing you do around cult surviving and sexual abuse?
Yeah. So I've interviewed quite a number of cult survivors over 50 in recent months, actually since the exposure of the mother and baby homes came out last January. So I don't know if you read about that here mm-hmm. in England, because it was mostly publicised in Ireland, but they found the graves of 9,000 infant deaths across Irish institutions, mother and baby homes, put into unmarked graves, which is also what happened to Indigenous children in across the colonies, Canada and Australia. So, and after that, I got into doing some activism about it, and then ended up putting out an advert on Instagram and interviewing quite a lot of cult survivors, and also draw my own experience about it. So, yeah, I've published a few papers and chapters. And a lot of the interviews that I've done have been with people who have survived a massive range of cults. So that could be religious, that could be political, it could be some kind of New Age cult or psychotherapy cult, and even one-to-one sort of couple relationships as well that are very oppressive and cult-like. Yeah, I interviewed one person who was in a cult of three, and it was just the just whenever it would be a group that would be enclosed, secretive, and with a top-down hierarchical structure, usually with a leader, a sort of charismatic leader at the top, that would sort of be the definition of a cult. But no group ever defines itself as a cult, so it's kind of still an open question about what that actually even is. So yeah,
I find that actually really interesting. I was doing some research today about, yeah, I just googled what is a cult, because obviously I've got my experience and my ideas and everything, but finding like a straightforward definition about it is quite difficult. So like you've mentioned, there's a cult can be many things. It can be only a couple of people. Sorry, it's my doggy in the background. It could be, you know, anything. And I think in our society, sometimes we really recognize cults as like these spiritual things, you know what I mean? So that weird kind of satanic cult she was going to or whatever, but you don't realize how cults can be political systems and all these other kind of branches of society. And again, I think it's a really interesting thing to say as well, that we don't define, it isn't defined as a cult when you're in it. You're not going to start something up and go, okay, we're a cult, guys, here's the door, come come in and join our cult. I think for a lot of people, you can get involved with these groups and really not know or notice because of the nature of it until it's too late. Why do you think that there is like this kind of underlying thread of abuse that can happen within these institutions and these communities?
I think it's just really comes down to power and people. It takes a specific kind of person to want to be a cult leader, or to see themselves as that kind of charismatic figure who wants to attract a lot of followers and wants to be sort of adored in a way, or just wants to subjugate others. And there can be like quite sadistic reasons for that, you know, because of some perverse desire to have power over people and feel that sort of enjoy seeing people in fear. Or it could be something just ideological. They could really believe in like their own ideology. But I think the reason that a lot of people sort of are drawn to it is for the sense of community and belonging that cults offer. And so if, you know, if it's a quite a radical, interesting idea or just set of values that align with your own, like it can be easy to see why people might just go along innocently thinking that they are doing something that makes a contribution or doing something creative or meeting like-minded people. But that would be the place where, you know, the abuse can happen. It can happen very subtly and slowly, and it can happen just through coercion, control, and also it can be a lot more serious, like the cults that end up coercing people into mass suicides and murders and that kind of thing, so, or sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So, but I think just the power is always going to be, it's always going to open the door for potential abuse and violence to happen. So,
And how would you define abuse?
So there's a lot of different definitions, I guess. Like, you know, there's a lot of different forms of abuse and violence, but usually just having power over another. So a form of subjugation. So could be like child abuse, animal abuse, domestic abuse. Also self-abuse, like drug abuse, that kind of thing. But something that is a process that can go on, like repetitive process that chips away at something and erodes it and kind of destroys it ultimately. But that process of destruction can be just, you know, recurring and can take a long time. Like drug abuse, it's not something that just results in death straight away, or domestic abuse, but it's just more like something that just keeps being returned to and often gets worse as well.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Would you mind, Elizabeth, telling us a little bit about your experience as a survivor?
So as an adult, like I was involved in a few different cults, and something that might make it quite current and applicable to this podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about one in particular that I came across that I didn't join myself, but I was there and I witnessed it and I witnessed what happened. I feel a bit more comfortable maybe talking about that for now anyway, just
for sure.
So it was somebody that I knew. She ended up sort of dropping everything in her life to go and work in the Amazon, work for this plant medicine retreat center, which sounded like a dream. You know, it sounded like idyllic situation. And it was set up by a man who was just clearly abusing his power, and he was using his status and his money and his power to coerce young women into working for him, having sex with him, and doing all kinds of favors. And it was like an exchange of power in that way. And it just broke her down and broke down a number of other women who were involved in that. So it was just very destructive. But I think in each case, nobody had actually named it or called it out as a cult, because it still had an idealized element to it. It was seen as this romantic sort of, everyone was believed that they were sort of lucky and grateful to be there. And so also that kind of top-down power structure atomizes the group, right? So people don't have conversations with each other about what's going on. So uh-huh. Everyone was sort of in their own separate world. They weren't really allowed to speak out or say that they were feeling uncomfortable. And that didn't actually happen until it resulted in a suicide in this particular case, and then quite a few people came forward and talked about how they were abused, but it still managed to get pushed underground. Another example that I actually experienced was, without going into too many details, it was more like along the lines of a psychotherapy situation. And and in that case, there was somebody in charge who was grooming and exploiting sexually, and also forming friendships as well with women. And and because there was a power relationship, because, you know, it was happening behind closed doors and it was a secret environment, and there was people were very vulnerable. They'd gone there because specifically because they were vulnerable. They didn't feel that they could speak out, and they couldn't form solidarity with each other or call out what was happening. And also they normalized it. So, and also when a whole group normalizes or minimizes what's going on to one person or just a few people, it just gets erased. And so the people who were being affected minimized it themselves as well, because that's, you know, just kind of internalizing that sense of shame and disavowed sort of taboo around it. So mm-hmm. it would just lie dormant, and again, like, the power sort of wouldn't get challenged because people who wanted to speak out just ended up leaving on their own. It seemed like that was the only option, and leaving a cult in itself can be a very dangerous thing to do and very difficult, and people often get stalked or they get excommunicated. And it's that fear of losing everything that you know and, you know, rely on, and a group of that and community and sort of family that might belong to, that keeps people in that position, often very dissociated and trapped in fear.
Gosh, it's like, it's so interesting to hear about it from a more academic perspective and really understand it from the from outside of my experience, you know. One thing that I have come across time and time again, so I just want to clarify this, it isn't always men that are in charge of yeah. cults, it isn't always men that are the abusers, but, you know, we find a lot that it can be a man in the position of power, especially in the way our society is, and in my experience it has been that. One of the things that I came up against a lot back in the day with this kind of stuff, and having trying to have conversations with other people within the community or even the wider community about the behavior of some of the, you know, potential cult leaders or men in positions of authority who are abusing their authority, usually sexually. One of the things I come up against was I would always say, you know, this is, for me, it's really clear. If you're an authority, then you don't take advantage. You know, you have to be so strong with your boundaries, with kind of keeping those relationships sound and not crossing any lines. And one of the things I got back, and this was specifically related to somebody who was having, he was taking advantage of a lot of women sexually in his group. The argument that came back to me was that, well, he's also wounded. He's doing, you know, he's an amazing healer, or, you know, whatever it is, he's great at that. And everybody says he's great at that. And there's all of this evidence to show that he's great at it. But we have to kind of leave space for him to also be a human being, him to also be a man. And his trauma is obviously a sexual trauma, so he's working it out. And I always found that, like, it's the kind of a place that I can't understand, if that makes sense. To me, that sounds like an excuse. But to so many people in this community, it's like, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, we're all human. We've got our journey to go on. And that means we can do what we want, kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Have you come up against anything like that?
Definitely. Because in this case, you know, it's because of how sort of hyper-individualized this capitalist culture is, like, everything is sort of atomized. So people do just see things through the lens of the individual, and especially if you've got it in like a self-help context or a healing context or psychotherapy context, they'll always be saying, oh, but, you know, give account to this person's trauma, or this person's going through hell, and also, you know, the victim and perpetrator are playing out a codependent dance. And there's truth in the codependency and the intersubjectivity and the way that, you know, people all sort of like feed into the power relationship in their own various ways. But at the same time, it needs to be named that the one with the power is the one who's dominating, the one who's in the authority, who's, you know, who's doing the violence in a way. And mm-hmm. And the one who normalizes it, if it does get normalized or minimizes it or doesn't speak of it, it could very well be like a Stockholm syndrome thing, or, you know, or just gaslighting, and, you know, just a feeling that almost like with child abuse, the stakes are far too high for children to speak out, because what is going to happen, they're going to end up in care, or mm-hmm. they're going to speak out against their abuser. Usually, you know, they will identify with the abuser and love the abuser. And that is the most kind of confusing part, I think, of this power dynamic. Like Alexandra Stein talks in her book Terror and Brainwashing about attachment, and about how, like, people who've been, particularly people who've been born into cults, might have like a disorganized attachment, like, so that they're not secure or avoidant or anxious or just one thing, but they're kind of all over the place and like identifying and attaching to anything that kind of gives them that sense of security. But that's often just an illusion, you know, it speaks to some kind of dissociated place, a trauma. It's like a trauma bond, you know, so it's uh-huh. like a feeling of enmeshment. And people who position themselves as kind of cult leaders, they are often very expert at finding the trauma in somebody else and knowing how to, be a magnet for it, really, and sort of be yeah. to present as if they can heal it, but really they are just traumatizing. So Daniel Shaw, actually, in his book Traumatic Narcissism: Relational Systems of Subjugation, talks about how the traumatizing narcissist or cult leader, it's like a similar thing. And his book is structured with different chapters, one about the couple relationship, another one about the psychoanalytic relationship. And so almost like to show how it isn't just the standard cult that you get like in Wild Wild Country or something, but it's mm-hmm. but it's also something that is in our society. It's almost like our society is built in this way of like consumption and production, and how, you know, you've got service, people in service, and people who are benefiting from that service, or the kind of the master servant dynamic. And and he talks about how the traumatizing narcissist is someone who has so much shame, toxic shame, that they can't own or express or feel. So they project it out into the other, and the other feels that shame. And, you know, the whole kind of cycle is built on a sort of enmeshment of shame, if you see what I mean, like that everyone's yeah. attached through that trauma and through that shame. And that's what mm-hmm. keeps people in it, because it becomes like an addiction almost.
Wow. Gosh, I feel like I almost need to take a break and just think about what you've just said. Wow. I mean, I've definitely found that, having had experience of being in cults or, you know, around those institutions, it has really affected like my, obviously, as it would, my journey after leaving. So like my personal journey, my spiritual journey especially, has been massively affected by, like you were saying, being in those tangled trauma enmeshments and just literally being confused, like confused about what is the right, like what is true, what is right, what is wrong, am I wrong? And you find a lot in the spiritual communities, like you know, there's this whole thing about speaking your truth, which, you know, I'm all for like authenticity, but this whole thing about kind of speaking your truth, and that's kind of like the be all and end all.
It's kind of so converse, contrary even, that we have this community which is all about speaking your truth, but then we have these people in these positions who essentially suppress this. So it's almost the opposite of what multidisciplinary omnist spiritual beliefs sort of believe in. It
yeah, but just thinking about in the spiritual community or the new age kind of community, that is that sort of imperative to speak your truth, it's that again is a really sort of individualizing thing, that, you know, everyone has the right to speak, everyone has the right to have their own sort of take up their own space, and but really, like, people do abuse that well, it's not just people, that's not individuals abusing it, that's a system that's kind of set up for abuse to happen, because we're not all in the same place or subject position in society. Like, we've all got different privileges or not, and people hide behind those. And so, like, I'm thinking about the psychedelic world and how so much abuse has taken place in that. I've heard of, like, people like using cattle prods to torture people on DMT trips, or like really horrible sort of sexual stuff that should come with a trigger warning, but, you know, like, stuff that as soon as people are under the influence of those mind-altering substances, they're a lot more malleable and also far more dissociated and very open as well, you know. So that is an easy way to get in and really abuse their power. So I think, yeah, just that notion of abuse and power dynamics isn't spoken about enough in the new age and spiritual communities, because people maybe don't want to know, because the ones who are benefiting from it, they don't want it to change, you know. Why would they? It's all in place for them. And then other people will either, you know, more vulnerable people will either get sucked into it and maybe see if they survive or not, you know, with however much damage that happens to them, or they'll just get out and leave quietly, and there isn't really that much opportunity for people to come together and talk about how they're being harmed.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what happened to me. I one day just was like, this is enough, and packed a bag and ran away, like literally ran away. It's another reason I'm so grateful for you, Liz, because you're one of the only people who I actually felt like I could speak to about it and who would understand. Because there is also this thing I find a lot in the spiritual community where, because we're all about self-revolution and, you know, it tends to be your fault, you know. So anything that happens to you in your life is like your fault. You could do, you know, this whole, even the kind of way that we do motivational speaking and everything, it really puts the onus on you. Like, everybody's got, you know, this has been said recently, everyone's got the same 24 hours in the day. Just, you know, this kind of shit where, you know, it's your fault. If this thing doesn't work out, if you've made that choice to do that thing, then it's your fault. And I found that like a really difficult thing to kind of get past, like with my past and the abuses that I've sustained. Because it isn't actually your fault. Do you know, in that way, you know, it's, I don't know. Could you explain a bit more about that kind of side of things better than me, maybe?
Yeah, I think, again, that comes down to the individualizing nature of our culture, of capitalist culture, but also the self-help culture, and I guess also religion as well, because, you know, it's based on this notion of sin, you know, that original sin, and that people, we are sinners, and that there is, you know, one God and Jesus that we, you know, patriarchal God, basically, that we wait for, sort of these Abrahamic tradition that, and we're never going to be enough. So everything, so it's all sort of based on a culture of victim blaming from the start. But then within that, there's, because it's very individualizing and individualist, it's like if something is, if someone's being abused, there are no avenues that they can really go to call that out or get support. There isn't really any safeguarding, and there needs to be, because take like the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's a very hierarchical structure, a bit like the Catholic Church, it's very phallic structure with you know, the Pope at the top. And in the Witnesses, because it's even more sort of like secretive in some ways, because it's smaller than the Catholic Church, has a smaller reach, they've got their brothers and their elders and, you know, the people that they would you would go to if there are any problems. But it's never you're going to them to say that you've been abused. It's them calling you out from the meetings to say that they're unhappy that you have broken some rule, some arbitrary rule, like you've fallen for somebody or you've had some kind of affair or whatever it is that you know, and then you face being disfellowshipped. And that's the crunch point that everyone's trying to avoid usually. I mean, you know, the tide is turning now because the cult leaver community is growing. You know, there's a lot of ex-cult members and people are, particularly in America, like in the USA, sorry, they are sort of calling out the evangelical movement because it's so fundamentalist. But it still has such a massive reach on people. It's just everywhere in society. Like in Brazil, there's a church that is also offering psychoanalysis. So it's kind of like these priests occupying the position of the master as well, and the analyst, mm-hmm. the one that you have to go to, you know, tell me who I am and, you know, give all your power to that person because they're the expert of not only the word of God, but also of every follower's life story as well, right? So mm-hmm. it's so these kind of charismatic churches and leaders are really popping up everywhere, and not obviously not just in religion. Like there's a lot of white supremacy cults, there's a lot of kind of fundamentalist sort of fascist movements. There's things on Reddit like the incel movement, you know, digital movements that could also have cultic elements to them. It doesn't always have to be like you know, one man sitting on a throne or something, you know. It's because a lot of cult survivors that I've spoken to, they never even met their leaders. Their mm-hmm. leaders were like you know, lived in a different country, or they were dead, or but they still had, you know, the teachings still lived on, or they were even like, you know, invisible or something, you know. It's like they spoke to them telepathically or something like that. But uh-huh. it's about the power, and then the leader would often have beneath them these kind of lieutenants who would operate, you know, like working for them. So a bit like in a dysfunctional family structure where you've got the traumatizing narcissist and then the flying monkeys who are doing their job for them, who are sort of mm-hmm. making sure that everyone is not challenging the way the power is, you know, and definitely keeping the leader in the phallic position, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess that's the thing, is like even when people want to speak out about abuse, the power structure is so totalizing that it's almost impossible to break through. And so really the only option is to get out. And that is difficult. Yeah.
You mentioned capitalism a couple of times there. Do you see our Western culture in somehow being complicit as a stage of the grooming process to, I guess, increasing the propensity for certain people to be more likely to be sucked into these situations.
I think there's definitely, I think the way that it's sort of set up is as a kind of marketplace, right? So with this kind of free market economy, people are all sort of supposed to be like in competition with each other. And then, you know, the way that workplaces are set up is, you know, with usually hierarchical, with a boss, and that kind of hierarchical system that mirrors like the church or sort of cults, you know, groups as well, with this kind of patriarch calling the shots, and then everyone else sort of working for that or trying to climb the ladder towards that. So definitely I think it's already set up, and actually even the school system is set up to set people against each other in competition, and, you know, and also make people feel really bad about themselves. Like it's not, well, I don't know what your experience of school was like, but, you know, it was never like, oh, you're doing great. Like, you know, it wasn't sort of bringing the best out of people. It's usually looking at, it could be quite dictatorial, you know, it's quite sort mm-hmm. of oppressive, you know, even mm-hmm. the just doing exams, that kind of thing. It's all about like making you doubt yourself and, you know, have to be coerced and controlled and disciplined. Yeah. So.
Sure.
Yeah, I remember in school being, they had this horrible rule, which they still have in place in my friends' kids' schools now. You can't just freely go to wee if you need to wee. I think that's the most bizarre thing in the world. And the fact, I know it's a really small thing, but the fact it stayed in place for so long, literally telling someone that they can't expect, you know, function their bodily functions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That in itself always was weird with me. It sat really wrong.
Yeah.
That's just one of many examples in like the schooling situation where you really don't have your own will or volition.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how, like, in the more sort of disciplinarian schools, you know, like the troubled teens industry, like for children and young people who don't fit into the standard school system because they are troubled in some way, you know, or they've been deemed to be troubled. And then there's that kind of school to prison pipeline kind of situation, because it's because they're sort of set up to discipline people so much that, you know, later on they're then just, you know, conditioned to be subjugated and self-subjugating, and also to mm-hmm. subjugate each other, you know, look out for who's doing wrong and can tell the teacher whatever. So yeah, it definitely, despite it, you know, being supposedly like free market, it does impinge on our freedoms. And I suppose even like the New Age culture is something that is supposed to like allow for that kind of freedom and freedom of expression and, you know, creativity and free love and so on. But I guess because of the already, you know, entrenched conditioning, again, people are slipping through the net who, you know, predators are sort of infiltrating those places, because whenever there's vulnerable people, there's, you know, good opportunity for supply, you know,
which mm-hmm. is quite... Oh, it's scary to put it like that, but you're totally right. I mean, it's interesting talking about, you know, the conditioning that we receive at school and how that can affect this. Because if I look back at my own experience, you know, it was drilled into me, and maybe it was because, you know, I'm my mum's black, we're from Peckham, we had to behave. It was drilled into me that I had to respect authority, you know, no matter what the authority was saying. I had to respect it. And as an adult, that's definitely something that I've realized isn't true. But it kind of, I feel like, paved the way for me to fall into these places and be too scared or self-deprecating to actually question something that I know wasn't right. I remember the first time I went to meet, I went to this cult situation with a friend, and because I had a couple of friends who were already there, I felt like it should be okay. From the moment I met the guy in charge, I knew, I just knew it was not right. The whole setup of this situation was not right. But because I had these people around me saying, no, it's cool, even though I went to them and said, I don't trust this situation. I mean, look around you. Do you trust this? This is not like normal. I don't feel safe here. Their feedback to me was like, no, Nikki, don't be uptight. Don't be uptight. It's cool. Like, you need this. Like, this will be good for you. It's such a crazy thing to think about. And this guy in particular, he lived in a house. He was an Osho. He was inspired by Osho or Rajneesh, Wild Wild Country, if any of you guys have watched that. And he pretty much lived the same way, but in Kilburn, in London. And he had this big house, like multi-million pound house. I walk in there, there's like four Bentleys in the drive. Kind of go in, he's all in his like sannyasin outfit, you know, like his robes, and then there's just like women after women after women. There's like 20 women living in this house, and they're all just doing, you know, someone's sweeping, another one's cooking dinner, another one's doing, you know, whatever. And I start talking to these women. For me, this is strange. I'm like, why is all these women in the 21st century in this house with this man? But I start talking to them. I'm going like, why are you here? And they go, oh, he's so amazing, he's literally given me, you know, a new life. I'm from Australia and I was sexually abused as a child by my parent, or I was, you know, abandoned as a child and I have nobody. And the stories were all the same. And it was really clear to me, well, these are all women who are desperate for care, love, support, safety, a father. And this man is here completely taking advantage of that, to the extent where they're literally doing everything for him and also giving him sexual favors whenever he wants it. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know that. And then he was very interesting because he was like, this is a funny thing that I find, and maybe you can attest to this, Liz. Again, within the spiritual community, these leaders, they are charismatic. And a lot of the time, I find that they actually do have a skill set. You know, so they actually can do some of the things that they say they can do. So this guy was like a herbalist, an osteopath, all these different things. He was given treatments. I had some treatments from him and they were great. I mean, they weren't, you know, any worse than my local acupuncturist. But it was the things that he did. So in those moments when you were alone with him, he would start to tell you what was wrong with you. You know, but not like, oh, you've got something wrong with your knee, more like in your soul. So he'd tell me things like, you're like a boy because I loved martial arts, or you need to stop doing martial arts, you look like a boy. I'm telling you, dear listener, I don't have a boy's body at all. I'm quite nicely hourglass shaped. I'm quite happy about that. But like, you know, he'd tell me I was straight up, you look like a boy. He'd tell me I was a cracker, you know. So he was Jamaican, and he would tell me that I was, you know, essentially white, you know. So anything that he could say to kind of break me down, take away the things that I had to support myself, he did over time. And even now looking back, I mean, that experience for me was over a decade ago. It still is so visceral. I can tell the way that it affects my life every day, the way that I interact with other people, especially the way I interact with men, completely changed after these experiences. The safety that I felt in going to places to try and receive some kind of healing or learn about how to have some personal evolution, that now it's quite a big deal for me to do, to kind of go into a new group of people. I get really nervous doing it because I just don't know what's right, what's wrong, if I'm going to get confused. Has being a survivor of being a cult survivor, how has that have affected your spiritual journey and the work that you do?
I mean, in every way, I think, because I think the thing about sort of wanting to develop yourself and like heal is that it's quite counterintuitive when you have got such a lack of trust. You know, when mm-hmm. when your trust has been broken, especially so young, and you just feel like there's danger in every possible authority figure, particularly authority uh-huh. figures, but also the people that surround them, like the so-called flying monkeys, or the people who just turn a blind eye to power and its abuse, or people who mm-hmm. want to be powerful, and you can sort of tell who those people are. But I think because I was sort of born into a Catholic cultic situation, which I don't want to go into because it's it would just be better not to go into that here. But I think I was already had a very sort of disorganized way of relating to authority figures. I just couldn't really tell who was safe and who wasn't. And not only sure. the authorities, but also people underneath that. You know, I think it would just be like a really confusing environment for me. So in terms of like spiritual development, we can't really develop alone, right? We need others. We need each other. Like, we need community to heal. But then if you really struggle with being in groups because of these, the fear that these dynamics are going to repeat ad infinitum, then that's a really confusing and scary thing to, you know, go back into them and then mm-hmm. see power at work. And I think that's the thing, is like, you know, just how common it is that It isn't just the church. It isn't just confined to priests or to, you know, people who are quite overtly abusive, but that there are subtle forms of abuse or sort of covert narcissism. You know, people who like desperately want to be in positions of power, or like, you know, white shamans, you know, plastic mm-hmm. medicine men, that kind of thing. It's like, it's a very, it's seductive to others. And then, you know, it can, anything that has a lot of a high concentration of power can feel seductive to, I think, everyone, you know, because it's a charismatic situation, and it has a kind of magnetism to it. But I think, for me, it would always leave me feeling quite disturbed, you know. So mm-hmm. I would feel like afraid and disturbed, and wanting to put up some barriers, and, you know, wanting to get out, really. So in terms of my own like sort of journey in terms of psychotherapy, healing, spirituality, and so on, I've really had to go carefully when it comes to groups and other people, and just feeling things out, not knowing who to trust. Because I suppose you need to have very strong boundaries to survive yeah. those situations as well. And boundaries are something that hopefully are taught in early life. But if you're not taught them, if they're not installed, then you can be vulnerable to those mm-hmm. kind of abuses and attacks.
Not only not being taught them, but being actively told that you're not supposed to have boundaries.
Yeah,
that's particularly dangerous.
Exactly. If they're broken down, if they're sort of just if you're not allowed, if you're not allowed to have them, and also if, you know, in cases of like sexual abuse and real sort of intimate abuse, like if there isn't really a sense of separation between self and other, so there's no sort of lines between, you know, it's almost like where do I stop and the other begins. Those kind of lack of that sort of lack of definition or lack of separateness can make a group experience very scary, especially when there's you know, someone presenting in a leadership position as group, as a priest or master, or, you know, shaman, some kind of figure that is in the position of the one who knows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think what's great about, you know, the digital world is that you do have access to other people, perhaps more marginalized people, or like survivors or abused people, or people who don't necessarily fit into those groups more naturally or feel entitled to take up space in those ways. So so there are other ways that you can sort of develop yourself and learn, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always another way and a safe way for you to be able to find. Do you have any tips for people who have survived cults or abuse, just in the way they can move forward in their life, or just any tips that you've kind of found from your own growth?
I think definitely finding others who have had similar experiences, not finding another cult, hopefully, but finding people who understand or have been through a process of be it deprogramming or sort of looking at the coercive control and brainwashing techniques and try to sort of unpick that and disentangle themselves and sort of find what is true to them and what was the conditioning, what was put into them. Finding other people who've been through that is really valuable, and that could be people who have experienced abuse as well, like you know, there's a lot of resources on the internet and on YouTube about sort of narcissistic abuse and recovering from that and identifying that, and they can be really helpful, like those abuse survivor communities online. And it can also be a way of, you know, keeping yourself safe if you don't feel able to sort of come out of the closet as a survivor, you know. But then there are also real life networks and groups of people that identify as survivors, and there's a growing movement of people who are actively critiquing cults and abusive relationships and narcissistic sort of coercive control. And so then, you know, I guess the first step would probably be some form of education and self-learning, and then the next step might be some form of activism, you know, so be that like helping others, you know, raising awareness and maybe writing, or, you know, finding some outlet of expression, art, whatever that is, and also just reclaiming the sort of lost parts of the self that have been lost to the abuse or been damaged by the abuse or traumatized, because trauma is, well, some say in psychoanalysis, say that it is the unsayable and what can't be put into language. So if you find a way of symbolizing it, that's a really helpful way to process anything. Mm-hmm. And that can also be through, I don't know, drama, acting it out, some kind of performance, some art, photography, visually, whatever works for people that isn't too overwhelming. Because it is like a different life, I think, when you come out of a high control group, cult, or abusive dynamic, you're sort of, you feel like you're on your own. And in many ways you sort of are, but the potential for growth is phenomenal. So it's worth it. But it just takes, there needs to be something else to fill that void, because you know, cults can be so devouring and overwhelming and time consuming and energy consuming.
Yeah. That's like, that's some amazing advice there. Really amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I did want to do a bit of signposting to a couple of links that I've found online relating to that. So if you're in the US, I think it's called daretodoubt.org. And if you're in the UK, it's cultinformation.org.uk.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those provide resources to helping people who've experienced cults to get the support they need. If you're also in the UK, Mind Charity, they're more general in terms of mental health, but have lots of resources and can point to services local to your local area.
There you go. So if you are, dear listener, somebody who has experienced this, then you may feel alone, but you're not. So do a bit of research for yourself and find the people who can be of a support. So Liz, before we sign off, I just wanted to ask you a bit about your work with Her Story London. And yeah, so just tell us a bit about that, because I find it really exciting. You're doing the most amazing activism there online.
Oh, thanks. No, well, I guess I set it up after the Mother and Baby Home reports came out, and I was feeling quite powerless. I had not had any contact with my biological family for many years. There was a lot of trauma there, and after meeting them, that sort of there's a lot of secrecy, as there is with cults and religious groups and high control groups, and there's a lot of excommunication and silent treatments and that kind of thing. And so when this came out and suddenly it was all over the press, I was like, wow, that is my background, my experience. And at the same time, well, three people sort of came into my life. Well, one in person, but two others just sort of online through DNA Ancestry.com, who'd also mm-hmm. been born in mother and baby homes and adopted away, and then had gone in search of their birth parents and hadn't had any luck, and then it sort of all came together weirdly, like during the pandemic. I think everyone sent off for a DNA test. Maybe they were getting used to the swab thing going on, but yeah. And then it kind of, so it created, I guess, a rupture in my life, and I wanted to find a voice, I guess. I wanted to find my voice and express what I felt was going on. So did some projection activism with a good friend of mine who does a lot of this stuff. Again, yeah, you know, with activism it can be a bit what do you say, like illegal, you know, sometimes it's yeah. a bit above board, you know, so sort of keep that on the down low a bit. But anyway, we started to do some things to maybe try and cause some trouble, like, you know, just in terms of raising awareness and going to, you know, the embassy and the Westminster Cathedral and these places that were, you know, famous for sites of power, and making art and making doing performance art, and also making public art that we put on to places, like one was in place of a slave trader statue that had been taken mm-hmm. down during Black Lives Matter and protests, and then put something up on that to honor women of colonialism and children as well. And so that's what we're mm-hmm. trying to do, to honor sort of people of color, marginalized people, particularly women and children, just as a way of kind of speaking to this like patriarchal violence that was happening, that the church was really, you know, revealing that it done, and the way that it had incarcerated so many women for nothing, just for the sin of the so-called sin of getting pregnant outside of marriage, or, and then having their babies taken away, going mad and getting incarcerated again because they've been driven mad. And you know, it's that kind of it's like all linked with colonialism, oppression, mm-hmm. patriarchy. And so started doing lots of art and activism to raise awareness about that. And then I guess just connected with particularly this movement called hashtag I Got Out, that is a movement of cult survivors and has Stephen Hassan also attached to it, who has written a lot about cult deprogramming because he survived the Moonies. And then there's like the work of Yanya Lalit, who also is a cult survivor, and she's written a lot about that, and Alexandra Stein, and several cult survivors who've then gone on to write up their research and write up their experiences. And there's a group actually in London as well that is a cult survivors group called the Family Survival Trust. And if anyone wants to join it, they just need to sort of look that up and get in touch with them, and then they have an interview just to make sure that it's a safe space, and then people meet online. And and yeah, just from there, just sort of started doing activism about other things that I care about as well, but mostly on the theme of abuse and coercive control. And yeah.
Seriously, go check out Her Story London on Instagram. Just every day you post, every post I see, I'm just like, yeah, yeah. It's an amazing page. And I really like, I have so much respect for you doing this work. I can't even tell you, you know, it's amazing work and really challenging work.
Both you the same through your work and everything. And thanks for, yeah, having me on here.
Thank you for your continual educating. This is something that it isn't a common conversation on the day to day, but it's such an imperative, like an important one to have, because it isn't something that, you know, should go missing down the cracks. These are people's lives. Mm-hmm. It's so precious, such a precious thing to be inflicting like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So many people, that's the thing. I think it's, you know, we talk about and we see Netflix programs about, you know, people who've survived cults, but there are so many more people who are trapped in cults and maybe don't even know it as well, because mm-hmm. of how coercive and brainwashing they are. And they're probably growing as well. I think they definitely are growing in numbers. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
So I just want to say thank you so much again for coming on and giving us your time today. I feel like, again, this happens a lot, but I'm going to have to go off and just have a good sit down and think, maybe a nice cup of tea after this episode. But as always, we are looking to build community. So if this rings true for you in any way, if you've had any similar experiences of cult survival abuse, anything like that, or even just a bit of confusion when you walk into these, you know, these new situations, or especially with your spiritual work, our DMs are always open. We're not counselors or anything, but we're just women who have lived a bit of life. So definitely connect with us if this is something that rings true for you.
Yeah, please do. We really do care deeply about the community. Mm-hmm. Community, it's if we don't put care here, then we're just another crappy chat show on Spotify. Mm-hmm. Being quite candid, I've been quite quiet this episode. I think there's a lot in there that I feel I need to process, because there are parts that feel like have related to moments of my life that perhaps I haven't even like discussed with people as yet. I haven't even discussed with my therapist as yet. Yeah, this has been so eye-opening, so very eye-opening.
Thank you both. It's been really great to talk to you. Yeah, stay in touch. Thank you.
Brilliant. And that's, I think, a good a note as any to wrap up for this episode. Thank you for listening to us today on the Afro Animus podcast. We've had Elizabeth Donahue on the show. I'm Jay Percy, the artist.
And I'm Nicola. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.